While thousands of Westerners flocked to Czechoslovakia in the wake of the Velvet Revolution, Dan Sparling experienced those dramatic events at first hand. In the second part of a two-part interview, he discusses, among other things, that intoxicating period and the changes that followed. Speaking at our studios in Prague, Professor Sparling told me he had two particularly strong memories of November 1989.
One was the first mass meeting in Brno, which was on Monday, the 20th of November, which was the same everywhere. I mean, in Prague and everywhere, it was the 20th. The difference in Brno, perhaps, was that there hadn't been demonstrations or people, you know, being attacked by police and so on. So there was earlier, as there had been, let's say, here in Prague and so on, there had been a year and a half of growing demonstrations. So nobody knew in Brno what might happen, whether when we send out leaflets saying, you know, gather on Freedom Square for this demonstration this evening, whether 10 people would come or 10,000 or whatever. And we went to the square, and it was totally surrounded by people's militia with guns, which we later learned actually were loaded, right? So, but we had no idea. This was the very first day, and nobody anywhere knew whether the state was really going to fight back. So it was very, very tense, and we got to the square. It was total chaos because I think there was one microphone for the whole square and so on. But because it was November, it was getting dark. And the organizers, in order to at least make it appear that the square was full, in the end, it turned out to be overflowing, but they thought, if everybody brings a candle, then if we light a candle, it'll kind of fill up the space. And then so there was, we sang the national anthem with the candle, and the whole square then suddenly sort of lit up with this, whatever it was, 20,000, 30,000 candles. That was extraordinary, powerful, emotional moment.
And what was your second memory from that time?
The other one was curious. We had a student theater in the English department with a very, very long tradition. We put on a big full-length play every year. And I had decided that year to put on a musical version of Animal Farm. I had wanted to do it two or three years before, and I thought, no way. By October 89, I thought, let's risk it. Maybe this is a sign that I did feel that there was a thaw going on. But that was already very, very late. That was, as I say, September 89. Anyway, we rehearsed it at the University Recreation Center in the Wysoczyna, and we came back on Saturday the 18th. And Monday we were involved in the student strike. And the students said to me, they said, why don't we put this on for the students? This is perfect. And I said, well, you know, it's in English. They won't get it. And they said, oh, we'll play it in Czech. And so on the second day of the strike, Tuesday or Wednesday, I can't remember, to this audience of whatever it was, 300-400 students, we put on Animal Farm in Czech. They sang the songs in English. They couldn't do that. But they, with virtually no preparation, they met for 10 or 15 minutes to decide which names for the different animals in Czech. They put on this whole extraordinary play in Czech. And it just one bit of it after another just had this incredible resonance. And I still remember there's that wonderful line where one of the animals says, you know, you pigs have gone too far this time. And you know, the whole room just erupted in cheers and laughter and so on. And I think, you know, never in my life ever again will I see such an incredible congruence of life and art. It was an extraordinary moment.
And what did the revolution mean to you personally, to both your life and to your career?
Well, to my career, it meant that within 2 weeks I was elected head of the English department and elected to the Senate and so on. So suddenly, from having been an ordinary member of the teaching staff at the university, I was kind of right at the center of things and, you know, electing officials and creating all the new regulations. And in the English department, completely, radically restructuring the whole degree program and so on. So it was tremendously invigorating from that point. For my life, it sounds maybe paradoxical, but not that much. I'm a person who has, I think, fairly minimal needs and desires. I mean, I never wanted to have, you know, a three-car garage or anything like this. I wouldn't have lived in this country if I had. So from that point of view, in terms of material things, it didn't really mean that much. We always traveled to Canada with my wife and children and myself in the communist years. Every second year we'd go there. So I could travel on my own if I'd wanted to. So there wasn't a huge change in that aspect. I suppose, again, people think I'm a little bit sick, but the first time when I really began to realize the changes and was slightly sort of caught by surprise was, and I can't remember whether it was a month later or 6 weeks later, they got rid of the Russian channel on the state television and brought in CNN, I think it was. And I was totally freaked out by having CNN in my living room. I just couldn't put it together because I had operated on basically on the principle that there's two worlds. So when we went to Canada, I would kind of turn a little switch in my mind and just have no problem living in Canada. It always took my wife 3-4 weeks to get adjusted. And then when we came back, it would be the same thing. We'd come back and I'd do my little switch and I'd be back in this society. And so I sort of adapted my wishes, desires, needs to where I was. And now suddenly this other world was here. And that for me was very, very psychologically, not so much upsetting, but just puzzling or something like that. I really sort of didn't know what space I was in anymore. And it got worse then when I started going to this grocery store, because I used to do the shopping, and found myself faced with the decision of having to choose which of the 10 types of bread to buy. Or which of the 5 types of butter? I mean, you know, there used to be one type of butter and that was it. You know, you didn't waste any time sort of thinking, you know, which one? Is this one better? Is it cheaper? Is it more expensive? Is it more quality? It isn't. I know this sounds like a really sort of radical leftist critic of the consumer society, but, you know, I still am allergic. I cannot go into big supermarkets here without feeling a kind of tension. I don't like this kind of society.
You also have written a very well-known textbook called English or Chinglish. I'm sure generations of students provided material for you writing that book.
Yes, this was the reason I wrote it, because it's a book about typical mistakes made in English by Czechs. And I just at one point got tired of correcting the same mistakes over and over and over and again. And I had started collecting them at some point. So I decided to put them down in a user-friendly way. It went through a first edition of 10,000 copies. This was just before the change in regime. This was October of 89. I had said I thought they should print more, and they said, well, you know, 10,000 is a lot, blah, 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 blah. It sold out, I think, in 3 days or something like this. And immediately they asked me to sign a contract for a second edition, and that was 100,000 copies.
Are you still teaching? What are you up to these days?
I'm not teaching. I left the English department in 2000 because the then rector of the university asked me to establish a completely new international office for the university. This was called the Office for International Studies, a very interesting type of international office with far more responsibilities than the traditional one. And that was 9 fascinating, exciting years. And then I retired from the university in 2009. What am I up to now? Well, I'm up to a North American Studies project, which involves the English and the Romance Languages department at our university. It's a big project financed by the European Commission. I'm involved with another research project of Czech theater criticism. I'm involved with a second project financed by the European Commission. This is an annual study tour of Canada for about 30, 32 students from all over Europe. And the other thing I'm doing is I work with an NGO in Brno called Brnopolis, which was established to help make life easier in Brno for foreigners, professional foreigners, people with, you know, university education and so on, who are working for this increasing number of international firms in Brno. Then we set up a thing called the Brno Expat Center, and I was the first manager of this, and this is really a place where foreigners can come and we give advice and so on. We organize events for them. And so
I'm surprised to read about this, because I was thinking that's something people would have needed years ago. I'm surprised that it's still needed.
There's a big difference between Prague and Brno. Brno really only began to take off as an international city about 6 or 7 years ago, when the kind of critical mass of foreigners passed a certain point and the critical mass of foreign firms establishing offices in Brno began to suddenly take off. There's also a difference in the sense that in Prague, you now have foreigners who, like yourself, who have been here for 10, 15, 20 years. Brno was off people's radar for a long time. It's not a tourist city. And so it's only now, with these firms coming there now, that it's turning into this kind of international atmosphere. It's also an interesting city because it's a highly decentralized city. We were talking earlier about everybody saying, oh, Brno's a village, blah, blah, blah. It's not. Brno is 27 villages. It's a very secret and secretive city. I mean, even Brno people don't know what's going on in Brno. There's no central place to find information and so on. So you can imagine for foreigners that it's doubly difficult. So we do this sort of thing. A lot of fun.
My last question is perhaps hugely off the point from everything else we've been talking about, but I was reading that you don't like the good soldier Schweik. And I was wondering, why not?
Well, I find it boring and repetitive to begin with. You read the first 30 pages and it's funny, and then you read another 30 pages and it's kind of amusing. And then you continue and it's basically the same kind of situations, the same kind of humor. So this, beyond a certain point, I just sort of close the covers and say, fine. Again, it depends how you interpret Schwaig, whether you interpret him as being this clever person who's using this neat little way to get through, you know, life without any problems, or whether you think that he's just dumb. I don't know which it is, but I don't like either. If he's dumb, I'm not interested in him. And if he's using this clever way to get through life, you know, by pretending to be dumb, I don't think that's a very useful model to promote, let me put it that way.